Hi everyone. It doesn't feel right to even have music at the start of this episode just because of the fact that what we're watching unfold in Afghanistan is so terrifying. And it's also confusing, and I get that. I think a lot of us, including myself, had put Afghanistan emotionally at the back of our minds. I can only speak for myself, but I just thought that the situation there was a bit more stable. And as of the last few months, and particularly the last couple of weeks, it's just descended at lightning speed. And all of a sudden, Afghanistan and the plight of the Afghan people is at the forefront of our consciousness. So I'm aware that for most people, they're kind of caught off guard and they're thinking, what the hell is happening? And I've had a lot of questions from you, probably the most demand for any episode ever. So I really hope this helps. The main question that I've had from you, to be honest, is what is going on in Afghanistan and how did this happen? So you don't just want to know what's happening, but also the kind of history of it. And how have the Taliban swept over the country and taken the city of Kabul, the capital city, at such speed and with such ease? I think that's what you want to know. So I'm going to go through all of it. And don't worry, you know this podcast. I will explain who the Taliban are. I will give you the context. You're never going to walk away from this feeling a bit lost. You're always going to feel actually much more comfortable with the story and with the situation. This episode, I'll give you that whole history, the what, the why, the situation now, how the government's dealing with it, both here and in the US. But in the next part, you're going to hear me talk to my best mate, who has been on this podcast before because she's worked within the civil service for the government. She's worked for members of the House of Lords. But actually, she's kind of coming at it from a different angle today because she has a very close connection to this crisis. She is half Afghan and she has family, direct family, direct blood, who are stuck there. She's just had the most unimaginable time trying to get a hold of those family members, trying to understand where they are, if there's anything in place to get them out of Afghanistan. And she reached out to me and said, can we do a podcast? And I said, absolutely. I definitely think part two is more important in a way because it's real. It's a real situation. It's not an abstract history lesson. It's actual people. So that's how it's being split up. I haven't introduced myself. I'm Julia Bell. I'm your girl for explaining politics and current affairs, making sure that it all makes sense. I hope I can help you unpack the whole Afghanistan situation. So with that being said, let's do it. Okay, where to start? I know some of you reached out with very straightforward questions about who are the Taliban and how this happened. So why don't I give you the most sort of basic run through of that? I urge you to read more around it, though, because I can't possibly do it justice, but this gives you a foundation. So in 1979, the Russian Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and put in place a pro-Soviet government. And so the period that followed after the Russian Soviets invaded, basically the decade of the 1980s, was defined by this war between the Soviets and a body of Afghans called the Mujahideen. The Mujahideen. And the Mujahideen's main objective was to overthrow the Soviets. So they were actually funded by the Americans. And I can imagine that's pretty easy to get your head around since America and Russia have always, I guess, been at odds throughout modern history. And in many ways, Afghanistan, I suppose, has acted like another country that's collateral damage in that dispute between these sort of two titans on the international stage. So you've got the Soviets on one side and you've got the Mujahideen on the other, who are literally shooting down Russian aircraft with weapons that were given to them by the likes of the CIA, the American CIA. And this war during the 80s, which I guess a lot of my listeners won't be that familiar with because you weren't born yet. Neither was I. I was born in 1992. This 1980s period was absolutely horrific. The number that you see floating around is that 1 million Afghan citizens died. 1 million citizens. And naturally, such a gruesome war meant that tons of Afghans, much like what we're seeing today, desperately wanted to flee. And Natasha, who you'll hear from in the part two of this, who's trying to get her family members out today, her dad was one of those refugees decades ago. So he managed to get out and get himself to the UK amidst this strife between the Soviets and the Mujahideen. Okay, so that kind of brings us up to the late 80s, early 90s. And after this sort of decade of war, the Soviets and the Afghans and the Americans finally got in a room and signed a peace deal. And that led to the Soviets leaving the country. So at face value, that appears like a victory. But, of course, the law of unintended consequences meant that that led to a complete power vacuum in Afghanistan. This total void where there wasn't an overarching power or an obvious person or group to take charge with enough backing of the country, with enough of a mandate, if you like. You know, this isn't a democracy. Think about it. Afghanistan was not a democracy. There's not this sort of safety net set up where people can all have their voices heard. It more just looked like complete chaos. And that is where, this sort of very chaotic scene, that is where the Taliban come in. And so at this point, we're sort of at 1994. And in this really rudimentary version of Afghanistan's history, but hopefully this is giving you a bit of an understanding of what's led here. So we're at about 1994, and the Taliban was essentially made up of fighters from within the Mujahideen. So that this group that fought the Soviets off, many of those ended up founding what is now known as the Taliban. And if you think about the sort of painful irony of that now, you know, the Taliban is seen as one of America and the West's key rivals, ideological rivals. But its roots are from an organization that was funded by and allied with the Americans. But anyway, the Taliban, which was this group of, I guess people say ultra-conservative, but I don't think that's a fair depiction. I don't think we should describe the Taliban as ultra-conservative. When I hear that term, ultra-conservative, I think of, you know, the deep south states of America. That's not a word. I would more use the word extremist, to be honest. Like, punishment for theft was getting your hand amputated. Punishment for adultery was women getting stoned to death in the streets, in public. Women's rights in general just kind of disintegrating. They were banned from going to school, banned from working. They had to be chaperoned by a male relative if they wanted to leave the house. This was the picture in 1990s Afghanistan under the Taliban. And the Taliban's justification for it was, you know, this was their understanding of how a state under Islam, the religion of Islam, should look. And I think it's very important to be clear here that this is their interpretation of Islam. Okay, this Sharia law that they were implementing was very much their idea of it, not the crux of the religion itself. I think that's very important to say. Okay, so that gives you a picture of Afghanistan's, I mean, very, very rudimentary picture of Afghanistan's history from the late 70s all the way up through the 90s, which brings us to 2001 and the 9/11 travesty, where the ripple effect from that had international eyes turning to the Taliban. And the reason that people looked at the Taliban, even though, of course, it was Al-Qaeda that orchestrated 9/11, was because the fact that Al-Qaeda's leader, Osama bin Laden, was being sheltered by the Taliban. So he actually orchestrated that attack from Afghanistan. So the American president at the time, George W. Bush, basically saw the Taliban as complicit in 9/11. They might not have orchestrated it themselves, but they housed the man who was instrumental in making it happen, Osama bin Laden. So they might as well be culprits all the same, was the attitude. And George W. Bush created a doctrine, the Bush Doctrine. Am I saying that right? Doctrine? Doctrine? Bush created a doctrine which said, and this is a quote here, "We will make no distinction between the terrorists and those who harbour them." And that was his way of saying, we're going to invade Afghanistan, because that's where Osama bin Laden did this thing from. And that's exactly what he did. And yes, indeed, he did it with the help of their biggest ally, America's biggest ally, us, the UK.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime. We are joined in this operation by our staunch friend, Great Britain. Other close friends, including Canada, Australia, Germany, and France, have pledged forces as the operation unfolds. More than 2 weeks ago, I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. close terrorist training camps, hand over leaders of the Al-Qaeda network, and return all foreign nationals, including American citizens, unjustly detained in your country. None of these demands were met. And now, the Taliban will pay a price.
So that was George W. Bush's voice when he addressed America from the Oval Office in October 2001. And that set the tone, really, for the next 20 years. The fact that America, the UK, and NATO had a military presence. Obviously, the amount of troops fluctuated, but we had a military presence in Afghanistan for two decades. And the stuff that Bush outlined there, in part, was achieved, to be fair. Yes, they did disrupt the Taliban. Actually, they uprooted the Taliban quite quickly. He did that briefing to the American people in October 2001, and by December 2001, the Taliban had fled Kabul. So it was a pretty quick effort, that initial part of it. They did put in place a quote-unquote democracy instead of the Taliban. And Afghans did get to vote in that in 2004 for their first ever democratically elected leader. So some of these things that were put in place did from the outset seem like achievements. And then not to mention, of course, the quality of life for many people in Afghanistan, particularly women. It seemed to dramatically improve. So girls and women were able to go to school and higher education. They were able to enter the workforce and they were even able to take up government positions. And then quality of life more generally, you know, authorities did not condone amputations and stonings in the street. So these things that were kind of set out to be achieved, in a way, were. But we'll talk about kind of that being a bit more complicated than it seems a bit later on. And then the big thing that was like number one priority, which was to eliminate the threat of terrorism. Yet again, in some ways, it was achieved, however temporarily, because Osama bin Laden was eventually tracked down and killed. He was found to be in a compound in Pakistan. And it was Obama that was in charge at the time of that. So, yes, a lot of this sounds like good stuff. And it's hard to argue, having seen what Afghanistan was like under the Taliban in the 90s, it's hard to argue that it wasn't a vast improvement. But like I say, it was far from a perfect picture. The Taliban were still present in pockets of Afghanistan, particularly in the south. They absolutely had no intention of fading away, and violence did flare up in areas, and they did continue to work towards getting their spot back in terms of taking back control of Afghanistan. And we did lose lives of British troops and American troops, and of course, many Afghan forces and civilians throughout those two decades. It wasn't like it was suddenly peace for all for 20 years. And that doesn't even speak of the sort of political difficulty as well, because since 2004, you know how I said that they had that election, it didn't just like from there everyone go, oh great, democracy's fabulous, I love this new government, it's perfect. Actually, any elections that followed that, there was heavy speculation that amongst Afghan citizens, that is, that the government was just full of crooks. And you heard, you know, lots of Afghan citizens say they were desperately unhappy with the political system. They thought that the people in charge were rigging elections. They thought, they, you know, you hear interviews of Afghans saying, well, I can't even take a case to court because I have to bribe the judge or else I don't get seen. And you have other people saying, well, you know, I could get my house burgled and I don't feel like the police are actually going to do anything about it. I don't feel like there's a sense of law and order. It feels like a very corrupt place to live, was a lot of people's accounts. And really, you know, what the Americans were doing, and the British, sorry, and NATO, was propping up a bit of a house of cards. Yes, vast improvements were made, and there's no way that I should dare to take away from the efforts of our brave service people. But we have to all admit that the situation there was very fragile. And the worry was, as soon as we took our hand away, i.e. as soon as we withdrew our troops, the whole house of cards would come falling down and the Taliban could take back control. That was very much something that many experts had warned of throughout the last two decades. All the same, though, really every president since George W. Bush and every UK Prime Minister since Tony Blair, who was prime minister at the time of Bush. He backed Bush in the initial intervention in Afghanistan. Every leader of those two countries has been desperate to eke out our presence and to leave the Afghans to it. Each leader, both in the US and the UK, has hoped that their time in office would be defined as, you know, I was the one that got us out of Afghanistan. I was the one who got us out of this never-ending mess. This sentiment remained. We can't keep sending troops there. We can't keep losing lives. We can't keep spending taxpayer money to prop them up. And we have to somehow get them to a point where they are stable enough on their own that we can leave. And we have to make sure they're stable enough that there's no longer a threat that Afghanistan will be this haven for international terrorist activity that threatens us so that we can avoid events like 9/11 in the future. And for that, we need them to have a capable army. We need them to have a well-backed police force. The Taliban needs to be squashed so that we can leave Afghanistan in a better place than we found it. So that was the kind of pipe dream of every leader since 2001. Let's get to that point, and let's get to that point quickly, because God knows we can't stay in Afghanistan forever. But, you know, it seems for the past 20 years, every leader that's got into office has not managed to fulfill that dream. George W. Bush handed the situation to Obama, and Obama's presidency was defined in part by finding and killing Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda. Of course, like I said, they tracked him down hiding in a compound in Pakistan in 2011.
Today, at my direction, the United States launched a targeted operation against that compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. A small team of Americans carried out the operation with extraordinary courage and capability. No Americans were harmed. They took care to avoid civilian casualties. After a firefight, they killed Osama bin Laden and took custody of his body.
So that was President Barack Obama announcing the news in 2011. But, like I was saying before, despite his victory, he still could not withdraw American troops from Afghanistan. Just killing Osama bin Laden, because that was in Pakistan, for God's sake, that did not mean that, you know, America could take its hand away, so to speak. In fact, in Obama's first 4 years, he ramped up the troops' presence as commander-in-chief. I think he thought, right, let's throw loads at this issue for a short amount of time, completely squash the Taliban, and then we can train up their forces to fight their own battles and we can leave. But it just didn't work out like that. You know, good intentions don't necessarily lead to good results. And the Taliban were more stubborn than I think he could have imagined. So Obama kicked the can down the road, and it meant even when he left office in 2016, he had to hand that baton over to Trump, the third president in this sort of lineage of this Afghan mess. And he was a president who, I mean, I guess like the others, desperately just wanted America to get out.
We're like policemen. We're not fighting a war. If we wanted to fight a war in Afghanistan and win it, I could win that war in a week. I just don't want to kill 10 million people. Does that make sense to you? I don't want to kill 10 million people. I have plans on Afghanistan that if I wanted to win that war, Afghanistan would be wiped off the face of the earth. It would be gone. It would be over in literally in 10 days. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to go that route. So we're working with Pakistan and others to extricate ourselves. Nor do we want to be policemen, because basically we're policemen right now. And we're not supposed to be policemen. We've been there for 19 years in Afghanistan. It's ridiculous.
That was President Donald Trump in summer 2019. So just over 2 years ago, holding a press conference with the Prime Minister of Pakistan. And I remember at the time, it just seemed like quite an agreeable atmosphere. They were both in agreement that America should withdraw and Pakistan should help facilitate that, even though the Taliban were very much gaining strength. And that was obvious. We knew that. But they still felt all in agreement. Well, we should still leave. And so with that in mind, I think the emphasis shifted. Trump and his team, their thought process was more like, look, it's inevitable that the Taliban are making a comeback. We can't actually avoid that. All we can do is keep it at bay for as long as possible, but we can't do it forever. So why don't we just negotiate with the Taliban themselves? And that hopefully can mean that we can leave, and at least our conscience will be cleared, I suppose. And so in February 2020, Trump announced that the US and the Taliban had signed, I mean, this is so surreal, signed a, they called it an agreement for bringing peace in Afghanistan. And in that agreement, it's very simple. It basically said, look, we will leave. We'll get our troops out by May 2021. That's our timeline. As long as you guys, the Taliban, absolutely promise that you will cut ties with Al-Qaeda and any other terrorist organizations. If you promise not to host or promote terrorist activity, and if you stick to it, we will leave. That was the bare bones of it. There were other elements, so we'll swap prisoners, was another kind of aspect to this deal. And there was also, you know, the US trying to get the Taliban to promise that they would look after human rights, they would help women and girls to have better lifestyles than they did in 1990s, you know, allowing them to go to school and whatnot. But the bare bones was basically, don't promote terrorism and we will leave, we'll get our troops to leave.
The US-Taliban agreement entails a promise from the Taliban that terrorists can never again operate from Afghan soil. If the Taliban do not uphold their commitments, President Trump and his team will not hesitate to do what we must do to protect American lives. If, on the other hand, the Taliban abide by their promises, the United States will undertake a responsible, conditions-based troop withdrawal. That withdrawal means that our men and women in uniform will incur fewer risks, our financial burden will be eased, and our brave troops will return home.
That was Donald Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, in February 2020. So he, Secretary of State just means he was the top dog for all foreign policy. And he's the one who met the Taliban, Taliban leader at the time, and shook hands with him on that basis. I mean, I've been sweeping through this entire history and I can't go into everything in loads of depth because otherwise it'll be a 40-year podcast. But this deal, this kind of peace deal with the Taliban, we've got to talk about it for a second because it was just quite baffling. They made a deal with the Taliban when there was an Afghan government still in charge in Kabul. So the Taliban were not in charge of Afghanistan when they made this deal. I mean, what a way to undermine a government, corrupt as it was accused of being, and I'm not saying that wasn't the case, but to make a deal with the Taliban, who are a group setting out to overthrow that government. You know, it was just an odd thing to behold, not to mention the sort of ripple of doubt that cascaded across a lot of Afghans who remembered very clearly what life was like under the Taliban in the 1990s. You know, you had women who were in school or who were in university or in ministerial positions in the government saying, do you really expect me to trust that the Taliban, if slash when they do come back into power and overthrow the government, do you really expect me to trust that they're going to keep to these promises? And am I meant to trust you, America, that you're going to hold them accountable to that? Am I really your priority? You know, that was the point of view for a lot of Afghans who were basically just held hostage by the whims of the Taliban and the US government. And I think a lot of them just thought, this is just the Taliban's way of getting rid of you, so then you're out and they can do whatever they want. And they're going to renege on their promises to you as soon as it's convenient for them to do so. So yeah, there was this kind of disbelief that the American diplomats and American politicians were taking the Taliban as a body of people whose word they could trust, I suppose. All right, that brings me to the sort of here and now with President Joe Biden in charge. And that would be the fourth president in this lineage of, you know, the war in Afghanistan and that baton being passed along from person to person, regardless of whether they're a Democrat or a Republican. And in a weird way, you know, Biden and Trump are not known to be two men that agree on anything. But it seems they were on a relative wavelength when it came to the ultimate goal with Afghanistan, which was get America out. And in essence, I suppose, prioritise ourselves first, put America first. So Biden pretty much stuck to the plan that was set out in the deal that Trump made. This idea of we will get our troops out and we'll do that in a very quick timeline, to be honest. Yes, the date was moved back slightly. Trump said May 2021. Biden ended up sort of saying it'd be end of August, start of September, but a swift withdrawal we saw nonetheless, even while, like I say, the Taliban were making incredible strides sweeping through Afghanistan, taking back region by region. I guess the thought was, oh, well, we've made this peace deal with them. Hopefully everything will be fine. But even saying that, do you know what? I can't even say that because they were very clearly not adhering to the message that they had projected internationally. This new and changed Taliban was not evident. You heard and saw stories of violence, women's rights abuses. You know, there's stories of women and girls turning up to go to school or to go to university and Taliban personnel turning them away in areas that they'd reclaimed. So the Taliban was sweeping across the country and it was clear they were sort of reneging on the promises they'd made. But even with all that information, Biden stuck to his guns and pulled the US out. And with that, it sort of, I suppose, set the tone for NATO and allies and the UK to do the same. Boris Johnson very much kind of made out like, well, if Biden's doing this, we'll have to do it too. And I will talk about that in more depth later because a lot of people have declared how unimpressed they are with Boris Johnson, saying, why did you follow suit? You didn't need to do that. But we'll talk about that in a second. Now, look, like I say, Biden and Boris Johnson and these kind of allied leaders who had this military presence, they had a kind of timeline in their minds of what they thought would happen. They thought, okay, we'll remove our troops, and once the last of them come out, the Taliban will claim back control. It's kind of an inevitability. They knew this, right? But the timeline in their head was, it's going to take some time, it's maybe months. In reality, as we've now all seen, it took days. Literally day by day, I would wake up checking my phone, and there would be another BBC news update saying the Taliban have claimed yet another region of Afghanistan and onwards they march towards the capital. Bearing in mind, Afghanistan's not a small country. So it was lightning speed and it was shocking for everybody, including the UK and the US's intelligence services, or at least that's what they say. You know, this is much quicker than we could have ever imagined. And at this point, as the Taliban are sweeping up through Afghanistan towards the capital of Kabul, all eyes turn to the president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani. You know, what is the plan? What are you going to do? You're representing, you're the head of this government that the Taliban are, you know, sweeping towards and they're planning to overthrow. What are you going to do? Are you going to transfer power to the Taliban? Are you going to do that peacefully? Or are you going to refuse to recognize them and try to keep a hold of Kabul? What's the plan? And then, as I'm sure you read, on the 15th of August, President Ashraf Ghani posted on Facebook that he had fled the country. So the Afghan public, along with the rest of the world, found out that their president wasn't even in the same country as his own citizens while the Taliban reached the gates of Kabul. Imagine how that must have felt, reading that. I'll quote you some of what he wrote in the statement that he put on Facebook. So this is a quote from him. Today, I came across a hard choice. I should stand to face the armed Taliban who wanted to enter the palace or leave the dear country I dedicated my life to protecting. And then it goes on to say, in order to avoid the bleeding flood, I thought it was best to get out. Taliban have won the judgment of sword and guns, and now they are responsible for protecting the countrymen's honour, wealth and self-esteem. Basically, a long-winded way of saying, I knew I would die if I stuck around. So, hey, Taliban, Afghanistan is yours. It all happened so quickly. You know, it felt like as soon as the words exited Biden's lips that we are getting our forces out of there, zhum, the Taliban grabbed the country and the old government just crumbled, literally melted away to a point where it's crazy that they ever even existed. You know, the president isn't even in the country anymore. That's how quickly it crumbled. And the people who worked within that government for that president, of course, were left completely in the lurch. One interview that particularly struck me was one I watched on BBC News with Regina Hamidi. She was Afghanistan's education minister, a woman, bear in mind, working for the government, working at all, which is not how the Taliban would have had it in the 1990s. And she was clearly completely shocked by the fact that her boss, the president, had just upped and left. And she was clearly terrified for her life. Have a listen to this.
I'm in shock. I'm in disbelief. I did not think that things would happen the way it did. I didn't expect this from the president that I knew and a president who I trusted fully. Somehow in my heart, in the back of my mind, I still want to believe that this is not true, that he left. But if this information is true, that President Ashraf Ghani and his close team left without informing the nation, then yes, it's a betrayal to the entire nation of Afghanistan.
You're speaking as someone who is a role model for very many people, but you're also there as a citizen and as a mother. What do you think now for your own daughter?
The fear that every mother has in Afghanistan, the fear that every woman has in Afghanistan. Deep down in my heart, I keep telling myself to think that I haven't done anything bad, and hopefully I won't have to pay the price for joining a government position. But now I might face consequences that I never even dreamed of. And I guess that's the price that we pay for trying to make this world a little better than when we came to it.
Regina Hamidi there, reacting to the president's departure from Kabul in complete shock. And actually, it makes me feel a bit sick to think about, you know, what this woman and so many other people are going through. But later on in that interview, she actually voiced the fact that she didn't have any confidence that she had much time left to live. She was just kind of convinced that the Taliban were going to track her down and murder her, even though the Taliban were putting out this message saying, we're a changed body, we're not after revenge, we're not seeking violence. She was very clear that she had absolutely no faith in that. And actually, she was doing the interview, I remember her saying, from the hallway of her house, because it didn't have any windows. So she was that terrified that the Taliban were after her, that she was in somewhere that hopefully she couldn't be spotted from the outside. Just completely unimaginable. I remember when I read that Facebook statement from the president, or I guess we should say the former president, because he's literally given the Taliban the country. He just said, it's yours, please do a good job. I remember reading that and thinking, this surely will be the moment that Joe Biden is going to say, okay, perhaps we haven't gone about this in the best way. Perhaps we've made an error in at least the timing of how we did this or whatever. But actually, quite the opposite happened. Have a listen.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there. We were clear-eyed about the risks. We planned for every contingency, but I always promise the American people that I will be straight with you. The truth is, this did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated. So what's happened? Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country. The Afghan military collapsed, sometime without trying to fight. If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves.
So that was Joe Biden addressing America and sort of saying, yeah, I stand by what I did. Didn't quite expect it to go this way, but I still think we made the right choice. It was quite surreal watching that. I don't know. I guess I wasn't expecting him to be so sure of his decision. And it was, I felt very much like he was addressing America, not his allies, not the UK, not NATO, not Afghanistan and the civilians there, but America. I mean, I get that you're the leader of America, but that sort of international role, I feel a little bit like he's pulling up the drawbridge and he's isolating himself. And that's the policy that he's going for, much along the lines of how Trump operated, I suppose, that kind of America first policy. Perhaps there's the feeling that this is popular amongst American voters, so let's do this. And they've maybe lost sight or lost interest of how other nations, including the UK, are interacting with this. And actually, I should talk about us a bit more, shouldn't I? Let's talk about how the UK have played a role here. Actually, most of our troops were out of Afghanistan by 2014. But we did have this sort of shadow remaining, presence. And that presence was there to prop up Afghan forces, and I guess to aim to keep the Taliban at bay and to use our resources to do that. But following on from the Trump deal, and then, you know, when Biden sort of stuck to that plan, Boris Johnson kind of made out like his hands were tied and said, OK, well, you know, the Americans have made that choice. I guess we go along with it.
I think we've got to be realistic about the abilities of the UK or any power to impose a military solution, a combat solution in Afghanistan. The American government obviously has decided to take a particular course of action, and that is one that has the inevitable logical consequence that I set out in the House of Commons several weeks ago. And the situation has now evolved in exactly the direction that we said it would. We have to deal with those consequences.
So that was Boris Johnson answering press questions on the 13th of August. He didn't say it in those words like, oh, America made the choice and our hands were tied. But that was what I got from it was that was the inference. And that was on, like I say, the 13th of August. Let's talk about Labour as well here, because obviously they're going to have opinions. And as you can imagine, they have been critical. A month ago, when Boris Johnson confirmed, yep, we're going to go along with this, we're going to withdraw all of our troops, along with what the Americans are doing, Labour planted their flag against that idea. They said, no, we don't agree with that at all. This is us washing our hands of the conflict. That was the wording they used. And they said, this is no doubt going to lead to Taliban taking back control of Afghanistan, which is going to be a disaster. And to be honest, they were not wrong, were they? And that was a month ago. And since then, criticism from Labour on the Tories' position has gotten more and more aggressive. And I know it's their job to be the opposition, but on this issue particularly, they have been kind of full of disdain. But actually, this issue isn't divided evenly on party lines. Definitely not all Conservative MPs are backing their own leader, Boris Johnson. You know, it's not like the whole party is saying, oh yeah, his hands were completely tied, we couldn't possibly have kept troops there while all the Americans left. That is not the case at all. A number of key Conservative MPs have been acutely critical of Boris Johnson's approach to Afghanistan in the last few weeks. And interestingly, a number of those are ex-service people themselves. So they've got that connection, that stronger connection to the crisis than he has. So Johnny Mercer is an example, Conservative MP who served in Afghanistan himself. And he said it was, quote unquote, deeply humiliating watching this crisis unfold in Afghanistan over the last few weeks. And he went on to say, this is a quote here, Biden has made a huge mistake, but also we have a role. This idea that we can't act unilaterally and support the Afghan security forces is simply not true. So Johnny Mercer really, in other words, is saying, why do we have to follow what America does? We have our own powers. Why can't we act on our own to keep the Afghanistan situation from deteriorating? So that's his stance on it, not supporting Boris Johnson at all, really. And just on this theme of kind of politicians who have served in Afghanistan taking a stance against Boris Johnson, it's worth mentioning Rory Stewart. He was a very prominent Tory MP. You probably recognise his name because he ran against Boris Johnson in the leadership election in 2019. So in an alternative universe, maybe he would have been our Prime Minister. But he has been completely against Boris Johnson on this issue. He's not an MP now, I should say. So he kind of has more freedom to be critical. But he's really using that freedom. Have a listen to this.
The West had this very light, sustainable presence. US, UK weren't losing casualties. Only 2,500 soldiers left. And really, they could have stayed for the next 20, 30 years. So it's very easy for him to pretend that there was this enormous American and British troop presence, that we were hemorrhaging money and lives, and pretend we were still living in 2009. And that somehow there's no way we could have continued without losing all these lives and being stuck in the middle of the Civil War. Because there's nobody to say, this is nonsense, right? You had almost nobody there. All you were doing was providing a bit of air support to the Afghan military. By doing that, you were stopping the Taliban from taking over the country. Right? No American soldiers were getting killed. I mean, this is just totally mad.
Rory Stewart there, former Tory MP and cabinet minister. So like I say, he was a very high up politician when he was in Parliament. And another figure who's been very vocal from that angle is another Conservative MP, Tom Tugendhat. Really important name for you to remember just in the context of Afghanistan. And he spoke in Parliament on Wednesday, and it was a kind of iconic speech.
Like many veterans, this last week has been one that has seen me struggle through anger and grief and rage. The feeling of abandonment of not just a country, but the sacrifice that my friends made. I've been to funerals from Poole to Dunblane. I've watched good men go into the earth, taking with them a part of me and a part of all of us. And this week has torn open some of those wounds, left them raw, left us all hurting. And I know it's not just soldiers. I know aid workers and diplomats who feel the same. I know journalists who've been the witnesses to our country in its heroic effort to save people from the most horrific fates. And if this recall has done one thing, let me tell you now, Mr. Speaker, it's achieved one thing already. I've spoken to the Health Secretary, who's already made a commitment to do more for veterans' mental health.
Yeah. Such powerful comments from Tom Tugendhat in Parliament on Wednesday. Conservative MP, but vocally critical of how the last few weeks have played out. And his words were actually so powerful that all the other MPs erupted in applause, which it's quite rare that you see that in Parliament. Usually you say your thing, you sit down and someone else speaks. So the fact that people were clapping actually meant that the Speaker of the House, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, had to stop everybody and say, nope, we don't have time for this. We've got to carry on the session. Just on this topic of ex-service personnel, I've had quite a few people reach out to me personally on Instagram to share their perspective. In fact, I'll read you something that one individual wrote. Let me just find it. So he asked not to be named, but he said, I'm a member of the UK Armed Forces myself. I totally appreciate that everyone has their own opinion on the last 20 years, but many of us have either served in the country or we know people who have. Right now, there's a crisis, but the question many of us are asking is, what was our sacrifice for? Yeah, I mean, thank you for reaching out, and I'm so sorry you're struggling, and I can imagine that a lot of service people are. And actually, he's shared some links for people who are in that position if they need to get help. Do you know what? I'll post those links in the episode description for anyone who kind of can resonate with that and who might need them. Sorry, back to the kind of politics of it. Which is that, you know, this point I was making about how Boris Johnson doesn't necessarily have the backing of everybody in his party. Well, that was made particularly clear when he had to face them all in the House of Commons on Wednesday, the 18th of August. So that speech that you heard Tom Tugendhat make, that was from this session. And the situation, when it was deteriorating, it was clear that it needed to be addressed by all of our MPs, by our democratic representatives. So what Boris Johnson actually had to do was recall MPs back to Parliament, because technically they were on their summer recess. They were on their holidays. But because this crisis had, you know, such magnitude, they all had to come back. And that session was not an easy ride for the Prime Minister. Heavy scrutiny from all angles. And yeah, I know it's been a long podcast episode, but we've got to cover off what happened in that discussion in Parliament so that I can send you away with a clear picture of what the government's actually doing now. What are they pledging to do about this situation, and how does everybody feel about it? Okay, good Lord, I'm knackered. So what we're talking about? We're talking about the conversation in the House of Commons on Wednesday. So first off, I'll say it's actually the first time that it was a full house in the House of Commons, because of course, it kind of feels like it's history now, but there's been a pandemic, and that's meant that we have had MPs having to sit completely spaced out. We've had to completely cut the number of people that could be in there, and lots of people have had to link in on a janky Zoom call. And it's felt like a very kind of sparse environment. This, on Wednesday the 18th was an absolute baptism of fire for Boris Johnson to, I suppose, revisit the good old days of having the place full to the rafters. And it felt like everyone and their nan had something to say. So much so that Boris Johnson actually couldn't get through a single sentence without people interrupting him and wanting to speak. It was literally like he would get three words in and then someone would say, right, I'd like to interject. Anyway, what was said? So he laid out the government's pledges about this Afghanistan crisis. What are we actually doing about it? And the main one was, we are going to endeavour to get, firstly, all British citizens out. So diplomats, journalists, we're going to get them, you know, if they've been trapped. And secondly, we are going to aim to get Afghans, specifically Afghans who have helped us. So helped us with our efforts, worked within our organisations. And in terms of numbers, the government have committed to getting 5,000 Afghan refugees out in the first year. And then a further 15,000 or so out in the long term. Yeah, the long term. That's not me being lazy, by the way, with my research and just not bothering to get the timelines. That's their words. So if you look on the government website under Afghanistan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, that's what this is called, it literally says here, the scheme will welcome up to 5,000 vulnerable Afghans to the UK in its first year, with up to a total of 20,000 in the long term. It's wishy-washy. And I get that you can't necessarily make promises when a situation is this complicated, but I think they could have been a bit more specific, and it really was not received that well on Wednesday in Parliament.
The Home Secretary announced this morning that the UK will be taking 20,000 refugees from Afghanistan, but that only 5,000 will be able to come this year. What are the 15,000 meant to do? Yeah. Hang around and wait until they've been executed?
Yeah, exactly.
So that was Chris Bryant, Labour MP, asking the question very bluntly, but I get where he was coming from. A lot of these Afghans feel like, you know, like the education minister that you heard from earlier, they feel like they have targets on their backs and they're desperate to flee. So they're wondering if they've got a week to live, let alone over a year. And what are they meant to do in that time with, you know, what is essentially turning out to be a bit of a manhunt for a lot of them. And there's Conservative MPs, like I say, who have been equally critical. So another person, Tobias Elwood, Tory MP for Bournemouth East, he called this scheme woefully inadequate. And it is just interesting to see this many Tories go against Boris Johnson. So many of them are really unhappy with what he's doing. Although, what I would say is that Boris Johnson isn't the main subject of the fury from MPs. Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, he bore the brunt of a lot of backlash this week. Labour, the SNP, a lot of people not happy with Dominic Raab. And if you're asking why, I suppose the answer lies in the fact that I have been talking about an unfolding crisis in Afghanistan without mentioning the UK's Foreign Secretary once. So it's not what did he do wrong, it's what did he do? Basically, as the crisis was unfolding, Dominic Raab was on holiday in Crete with his family. He arrived on the 6th of August, so this situation was very much escalating as he landed. And the updates were pouring in about the Taliban's progress moving towards Kabul. And Dominic Raab remained in Crete for 7 days. So the UK's foreign secretary, the guy in charge of our foreign policy, couldn't really, you know, we couldn't get a hold of him while he was out there. He claims that he was attending meetings remotely, he was taking calls, he was doing what work he could out there, but that is kind of being widely disputed. And calls to the kind of diplomats stuck in Afghanistan were taken by junior ministers because Raab was on holiday. And the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, made his disdain for Raab's decision to remain in Crete very clear on Wednesday.
Mr. Speaker, the Foreign Secretary shouts now, but he stayed on holiday while our mission in Afghanistan was disintegrating. Mr. Speaker, he didn't even speak to ambassadors in the region as Kabul fell to the Taliban. Let that sink in. Let that sink in. You cannot coordinate an international response from the beach.
Oh, man. I mean, Starmer versus Rob wasn't... that was Keir Starmer, by the way, the Labour leader. And Starmer versus Rob wasn't even the biggest bust-up. I think Ian Blackford, the SNP leader, Scottish National Party leader, oh, my God, him and Dominic Raab, like, went at it to the point where the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, had to intervene and tell them both to, like, chill out. And I don't know if you've seen actual footage from this parliamentary session, but it kind of looked like Dominic Raab was taking all of these comments really personally. Like, it was really winding him up that people were cross with him about going on holiday. And you could see him, like, getting pissed off. And you could see him pointing and shouting. And you could kind of lip-read that he was saying stuff like, what would you have done? And you weren't even there. Yeah, he was just very visibly wound up. And since then, pressure has been mounting on Dominic Raab to resign. The Labour Party are insisting on it. Not that that has actually meant anything historically. And Dominic Raab has absolutely no intention of listening to that demand. In fact, a video circulating from yesterday where Raab was walking into 10 Downing Street and a reporter very plainly asked him, are you going to resign? To which he replied with one word, no. Okay, just to wrap up, probably the longest podcast I've ever done. The picture looking forward, guys, is bleak. I'm not going to lie to you, it's bleak. The Taliban, you know, projected this message that they are a changed movement. They even had a spokesperson speak directly to the BBC to say, we are going to look after women, women's rights. We are going to allow them to carry on having an education. We're not seeking violence. We're not seeking revenge. But the actions that we're witnessing seem to very much contradict that. And actually, just now as I'm recording this episode, one of the tabs that's open on my computer, I'm looking at it right now, is a story from the BBC talking about a manhunt that Taliban operatives are putting together to find people who, to find Afghan citizens who collaborated with the US and with NATO so that they can kill them. So the situation does seem to continue to deteriorate in terms of the sort of human rights crisis in Afghanistan anyway. Hopefully, at least now, though, you have some idea of the gravitas, of the scale of this disaster, and you can understand a bit more of the context as to how we got here and all the various parts that kind of the US and the UK have played in that. I literally can't cover everything. I really, guys, I don't want to receive messages saying that I've missed stuff out, because seriously, this is the best I could do. So I will leave it there. Please check out part two, the episode where you will get more of a kind of personal idea of the effects of this crisis as I speak to my best mate, just so happens, Natasha, because as I mentioned, her family are stuck out there. And I want to thank you so much for listening. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your kindness. Most of you are just so lovely, and I really appreciate that you kind of just desperately wanted my take on this situation. So I hope I've satisfied that in some respects. So yeah, thank you for listening. And please support me by becoming a patron. I physically can't make these podcasts without my patrons. There's loads of bonus content on there on Patreon for you to enjoy. When you do join the community, it literally costs less than a cup of coffee. If you can, you know, grab a latte when you're out and about, why don't you swap it out for supporting this podcast? If this episode was helpful to you, why the hell not? The link to do that is in the episode description. So join the community, come say hello and grab lots of extra content. And if you want to ask me direct questions or keep in touch, you can always follow me on social media at @JuliaBell_X. Okay. Oh my God. Big stretch. How horrific. I hope that helps. I hope you're looking after yourselves, because it's just awful. And it can get easy to sort of end up in a hole reading endless things and looking at horrific images on tap, but I don't think that's good for you either. So you've got to find that balance, and I hope you're doing that. Sending loads of love to you. Take care of yourself, take care of your people, and I'll speak to you in the next one. Okay, goodbye.